for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A new video shows French Islamist state fighters calling for attacks in France. Tensions escalate in Jerusalem after a fatal attack at a synagogue. And negotiators on Iran's nuclear deal face a Monday deadline. Joining me for the International Hour, the Friday News Roundup, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Nadia Bilbasi with Al Arabiya, and Natan Gutman with the Jewish Daily Forward. I look forward to hearing from you today. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And welcome to all of you.
Morning, Dan.
Good morning, Dan.
To see you, David Ignatius. France named a second Frenchman in a video killing of Syrian prisoners by the Islamic State. What's driving French nationals to join these outrageous groups?
Disturbingly, there is throughout the Muslim world an attraction for these jihadists in Syria and Iraq. They're very skillful at using internet propaganda. I watched some of their videos yesterday,
really?
And you know, they are so well made. They show a level of violence. You watch these videos, you see assassinations across Anbar province, accompanied by strains of heroic Arab music. And there are clearly people who are watching this and who were aroused to militance by the evidence that they're succeeding. So the French have identified two people. Interestingly, neither of them Muslim. One Portuguese, originally Michel dos Santos, and another from Normandy named Maxime Ouchard. And these two French non-Muslims came, have been fighting in Syria in this jihad with the Islamic State. Islamic State is, as you said in your introduction, broadcasting a propaganda to French Muslims saying, join us, rise up. And, you know, this is an explosive, metastatic problem. And for European countries that have large Muslim populations, I'm sure their security services are really struggling to figure out, how do we combat this? How do we identify people who have sleeper cells in our countries? How do we counter the kind of propaganda that's coming out of Syria and Iraq?
And now, Nadia Bilbasi, they're calling on these people in France to carry out attacks in that country.
Are you surprised, Dan? I think 3 years ago, when President Assad was slaughtering his own people and the whole world didn't do much about it, everybody said the jihad is going to come. And guess what? They came, and they came in mass. Not just the one who fought in Chechnya and Afghanistan, but it's inspiring a new wave of jihadists, completely different from Al-Qaeda. These guys, as just David said, are very sophisticated. They know how to attract not just the Muslims, but the convert to Islam.
What are they offering them?
They're offering them, I mean, all of them obviously motivated by the ideology of going to a better life, which is heaven. So they are not afraid to die. They're offering them also a defiance against the West. They're telling them that if you kill innocent people, well, I mean, they're not calling them innocent, but anybody for them who is also a Muslim, like myself, will be killed because we don't adhere to their way of living or the way they look at life, that basically you will go to, God will reward you for that. So they also attract the people who are disillusioned with life. Many Americans, many French, many Austrian teenage girls who are now working in ISIS female army. It's horrifying to see all these people who have nowhere to go, and they're thinking, oh, this is wonderful. We can go to Syria. We can get paid. We can fight. And if we die, we're going to go to a better place.
And Natan, this week, President Obama ordered a review of the hostage negotiations that have never taken place, or if they have, they've been undercover. There is a woman who is still being held by the Islamists, and she is American. What do we know about her?
We don't actually know much. This is basically the first time that the administration speaks out on how many Americans are held by ISIS. Until now, there was this attempt to keep this information vague in order to protect the safety of the prisoners. Now we know that there's only one prisoner left. She's a young woman from America, but we don't know many details about her. We do know that the administration has launched this review of the way it's dealing with the whole hostage issue because of the problem that ISIS is posing now. And while the administration is saying that they're not willing to re-examine the idea of not paying the principle of not paying ransom to the to ISIS people or to the terrorists in general, there is this discussion of how can you deal with it better, because what the administration has been hearing from the families of the hostages that had been murdered by ISIS was that they were ignored. They weren't seen as a national security problem. Were not seen as a priority by the administration. And this is one of these things that this review will try to look at again.
David.
Yes, I think, as Natan said, it's the anger, disappointment of the families who feel that they weren't listened to, they were kept at arm's length, that information wasn't shared with them. It's the ultimate nightmare for a parent to have your son or daughter held in these circumstances. You can only imagine. The U.S. Is in an awkward position, I think, in one respect. This insistence that we will not pay ransom to free hostages, at the same time that we saw President Obama authorized the trade of five al-Qaeda Guantanamo prisoners linked to al-Qaeda to recover one American hostage who was in military, Bo Bergdahl. And so I think families are saying, if you do it for people in uniform, does that mean that civilians have a different status? And how? So I think there is that anger. I hope that transcending all of this is just sheer horror at the level of brutality, that just the gratuitous effort to intimidate and shock that's displayed in these videos. Clearly, they're going after humanitarian workers, they're going after journalists. What does that tell you? They want to shut these areas off. They want to close any coverage from the outside, from journalists who could give a glimpse. They want to close off any Western humanitarian aid that could help people on the ground. I mean, it's ghastly, but that's what's going to happen. People will not go there.
But it's more than that, David. Actually, I just got back from the Turkish-Syrian border, and I spoke to a few people who've been held in ISIS jail. And they were telling me that they were targeting not just the foreigners, not just the aid workers, but also the Syrians who have any kind of skill. They were killing everybody who's a reporter, who's killing everybody who's a teacher, who's a doctor, who's a comedian. They're just wiping out the whole skilled population. They're left with the one who cannot leave Syria, who's uneducated, and they will be easier for them to control. And this is the tragedy. It's just for every foreign journalist who've been kidnapped or killed, there is at least 10 or 20 Syrians that we don't hear about. Actually, Syria is the graveyard of all journalists. And I spoke about this last week, actually. 88 of journalists were killed last year, and most of them are local or freelancers. And on top of that, about the ransom thing, also the person I spoke to, he said that the French paid, for example. The figure goes to $17 million for four French hostages, journalists who were in the same jail at James Foley. Of course, the administration policy is never to pay ransom. And that's the case for, of course, I mean, you can understand in a way, but you cannot but sympathize with the families because... always when you pay ransom, they will kidnap more people and they demand more money. And one of the reasons that people are joining ISIS is because it's a lucrative business. It's not just the ideologue who wanted to die, but also there's people who come in from everywhere, from Egypt, from Saudi Arabia, from Yemen, from Iraq, and they get paid tons of money in comparison to anything else that's offered by any military group in Syria.
Not
hard. I think this also goes to demonstrate how serious the threat of ISIS is. The fact that they are so systematic and methodic in trying, as Nadia was saying, to go after the elites, to go after the people that can talk about what's going on in Syria, after journalists and aid workers, it it's not just a terror organization that's randomly picking people off the street and kidnapping or killing them. There is a system behind it. And going back to what we discussed earlier, the fact that there is this attempt to radicalize back at home in Europe based on the ISIS doctrine. At the beginning, everyone was concerned of what would happen when these foreign fighters come back. But now what we're seeing is that you don't have to wait for them to come back. People are joining based on their perceived success, so to say.
Just a small additional point, Diane. I wrote a column in the Washington Post this morning that noted that one of ISIS's most devastating campaigns of assassination and intimidation is against the Sunni tribal leaders in Iraq, who are the people that the U.S. is counting on to be the boots on the ground that will get ISIS out of these areas that it's captured. But since 2009, these people have been working systematically. I cited a report. Almost 1,400 members of the Awakening Movement and Iraqi tribes have been killed since 2009.
David Ignatius of the Washington Post. Short break here. When we come back, we'll talk further. Take your calls. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at cancercenter.com. From World Vision, a Christian organization dedicated to serving the most vulnerable children, working in nearly 100 countries to provide fullness of life by tackling the root causes of poverty and injustice. Learn more at worldvision.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Associated Press is reporting this morning that U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has decided to pull back from nuclear talks in Vienna, leaving Iran's foreign minister to ponder an apparent new proposal from Washington meant to bridge differences standing in the way of a deal. With less than 4 days to go to the deadline, Nadia, is Secretary Kerry going to meet this deadline?
Well, he's very optimistic, and we hope that he will be able to conclude this deal. This is one of the biggest challenges in foreign policy. If succeeds, it's going to be an amazing deal for everybody. But the chances that it will succeed is very little. And I'm quoting many people, including the French foreign minister, Laurent Fabius, who said it's very unlikely that we're going to meet the deadline. The British foreign minister, Tony Blinken, future secretary of state. Everybody is just very realistic about, because the gaps on the issues are huge.
What are the issues holding up an agreement, Natan?
Well, basically what they're trying to figure out in this agreement is a way to make sure that Iran has, that the West or the international community has as much as the longest breakout time possible for Iran, which means that if Iran decides to break the deal and go ahead for the bomb, you'll have at least a year before they can actually do that. And that's where you go into the details. How many centrifuges, for example, can they have in order to make sure that they don't do it too fast? The West is talking about 4,500 or 5,000. The Iranian would want more. There are questions of how do you connect them and what type of centrifuges. A lot of this is very technical. The other part of it is what level of monitoring do you have on the ground? Can you visit these sites daily? Do you have to inform in advance? All these taken together will give the formula for the breakout time. And if you reach a position in which the breakout time is more than 12 months, I think most people, the P5+1, will be satisfied with that.
And it really, you're working not just with Iran, but with the EU and with other countries.
There are some differences within this coalition. They've held together pretty well. It's thought that the most militant are the French, that the French Foreign Minister, Laurent Fabius, with whom Kerry met, takes the hardest line. Close to the line of Israel, which is not a member of this negotiating coalition. The Russians and Chinese have stayed on board. There were fears that they would slip off. But I had a recent meeting with the Russian ambassador here in Washington. He wanted to stress how important these negotiations were to Russia. I mean, we'll see. We'll know a lot more on Monday, and we'll know how wide the gaps are, assuming that they can't close them all the way. And then I think there will be a very difficult and politically sensitive decision. Should you package the gains that have been made in the negotiations over the last year, and there have been some significant ones, do you put those into a package and then say, okay, we'll grant some limited relief from sanctions for that, and we'll continue working on the additional items. That will trigger strong negative reaction from Israel. It will trigger strong negative reaction from some U.S. members of Congress. But that may be the question that Secretary Kerry and President Obama are looking at on Monday.
Well, Israel still maintains this idea of zero enrichment, which is Israel's stated policy. Basically, they're saying under any agreement, Iran should not be allowed to enrich even 1 gram of uranium. But I think Israelis understand that that's not a realistic goal, and therefore they will have to compromise with something. What the Israelis are saying is that the ideas being discussed now are a far cry from what Israel can live with. And therefore, we should expect, once we know if we're going for an extension or if there's really a deal next week, we should expect a lot of pushback from the Israelis, which of course are not part of these negotiations but have influence here in the United States. And we will see that in Congress as well. And we're already seeing members of Congress demanding that Congress has oversight, that it gets to approve this deal. They still hold the ability to withdraw sanctions. So Congress does have a say here. Yeah. It doesn't mean that you can't bypass Congress, as we just saw last night with the immigration, but it will be more difficult.
Sure.
But there is a blame game here as well, that many people think that the Iranians are not willing to compromise. And basically because the decision or the card is held by Ayatollah Khamenei. It's in Tehran. It's not in Vienna. It wasn't in Oman. And this is an important point, I think. So for the negotiation to conclude on the 24th is really very unlikely that it's going to happen for the reason we mentioned. Also, Iran is not willing to compromise on enrichment. What you do with the low-grade uranium has already been enriched, whether it goes to Russia or not. Another point, Diane, is the Gulf state, actually, somebody was saying recently that the key now in this negotiation is also in Russian hands. And if you look at the relationship between Russians and the United States, it's at lowest point ever. So what is it, the incentive for the Russians to push the Iranians to compromise, considering the geopolitical change in the region? The situation has, even comparison to the last year in Geneva, this time in November, when they reached the interim agreement and the Russians were trying to conclude this deal, I don't think that we're going to reach it this time. And the most likely scenario, although the Secretary Kerry said no, that they're going to extend it again, and they will agree on another framework of agreement, and we're going to have a process. I hate to say it's going to be similar to the Israeli-Palestinian peace process.
So
I hope not.
We'll see what happens on Monday. And Natan, 5 Israelis brutally murdered in a synagogue this week. So tensions have certainly escalated. The residences of several Palestinians have been demolished?
Yes, we've seen a steady increase in tensions in Israel for the past few weeks, but this terror attack it does stand out as something unusual and horrific, even for what Israelis are used to. The fact that it was in a synagogue, that the people were murdered brutally while wrapped in their prayer shawls, that really shocked many people in the region. And also over here, we should keep in mind that three of the people that were murdered there were U.S. citizens. And the first immediate response we've seen from the Israeli government was to go back to a method that was in use a decade ago, which is demolishing the homes of the terrorists. There is a debate in Israel, in the Israeli security establishment, over the effectiveness of this measure. Some think it's a deterrent. It's a deterrent because it means that maybe this terrorist is willing to commit suicide while killing others, but his family will pay a price. Others think it just incites for more violence further down the road. But definitely Israel is going back to this measure.
David.
Well, the escalation of tensions in the area of Jerusalem and on the Israeli-Palestinian issue in general is just one more piece of bad news in a region that has been overwhelmingly bad news.
And you had an Israeli mayor suspending employment for some Arabs, and that too sparked an uproar.
Yes. You look back at the hopes that Secretary of State Kerry had that he could revive the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, the effort that he and Martin Indyk, who was his chief assistant in this, made, the effort that General John Allen, who's now responsible for our campaign against ISIS, put into trying to find a plan to reassure Israelis that they would be secure after the creation of a Palestinian state. Some very creative work that hasn't surfaced publicly, but from what you hear whispered was really a major American effort. So we're now at a situation where mistrust seems is, you know, higher than it was before that started. The distance to be traveled to some kind of agreement on the Palestinian, the two-state solution is greater, not less. It's a disturbing situation, especially for the United States and Israel, which, you know, have talked for a generation, the whole time I've been following the Middle East, about trying to somehow get this issue resolved.
I think this attack on the synagogue is a symptom and obviously not the cause. There's been a series of attacks by Palestinians, individuals, as much as Prime Minister Netanyahu immediately blamed President Abbas and Hamas and everybody else, but actually individual people who are frustrated by many reasons. The lack of political progress, the growing of settlement activities, the fact that this conflict is turning away, Diane, from being a nationalistic one over territorial dispute to a religious one. And let me think that this attack on the synagogue, it was not random. I think it was chosen on a purpose. They did not go into a cafe. They did not go to a bus. They went to a synagogue because they wanted to link it to this perceived attack by right-wing Jewish organizations that's been threatening to pray in the Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site of Islam, and has been provocation over this by many. And therefore, from a Palestinian point of view, it was obvious to go to a religious site to say, you want to pray in the Aqsa Mosque? We can show you what we do. So unfortunately, the situation has gone way out of hand.
I think it also goes to show all those, even here in Washington, but also in Jerusalem and in Ramallah, that I think that there is this possibility of maintaining the status quo, of leaving the negotiations aside and just focusing on conflict management. This comes to show you that it's impossible. With a lack of a credible peace process, there is no way to ensure that the situation won't escalate very quickly into these terrible things, as we've seen this week. And maybe even Secretary Kerry would want to think twice after he gave it his best chance, his best shot. It didn't work. But what happens next? How do you put in some kind of mechanism to keep the process going, to keep the sides engaged in something, so that we don't see it escalating so quickly as we've seen?
David.
As strange as it sounds, I think Secretary Kerry would start up the peace shuttle tomorrow if he thought that he had a chance. He really has the bit in his teeth on this issue. He's taken an awful lot of criticism, especially from Israel, which was wounding to him personally. But I think he does believe, I think Natan said it just right. What's the alternative if there isn't movement forward? How do people imagine this progressing? Because, you know, if there's no room for compromise on either side, you're just going to head to more and more of these incidents. I know Secretary Kerry believes that. Others in the administration do. You know, you saw hints that Bibi Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, might be interested in some sort of resumption of some kind of
what
talks.
What was the indication thereof?
Oh, the indication to me was somebody in the State Department saying that they picked up signs of that. I can't point to something specific.
You don't agree.
I don't think so. I mean, I think Netanyahu will be just happy to see the President Obama leave in office. He will wait for the next 2 years or whatever is left from his administration and wait for the next president who hopefully will be, from his point of view, even pro-Israel. And we're not going to do anything because they still have 6 more years before they do anything, the first term and then the second two.
Netanyahu was under political pressure at home, as always. He manages to build these coalitions that maintain him under pressure all the time. Some of it is used as an excuse to the Americans, but some of it is real. So on the one hand, he doesn't have a lot of room to maneuver with his right-wing coalition to any kind of grand peace initiative. On the other hand, he also cannot be seen as the prime minister who does not provide security for his people. And therefore, if terror continues, if there are more acts of violence, Netanyahu will have to do something, either diplomatically or militarily, to show that he's in charge.
Natan Goodman is Washington correspondent for Channel 1 Israeli News and the Jewish Daily Forward. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. On ISIS. Here's an email from Dan in Sacramento. He says, I'm puzzled as to how all these Europeans are making it to the Middle East to join ISIS. What happened to the no-fly list? Apparently, there is a breakdown in the monitoring of online chatter. If so many things are getting out, how do we know who's getting in? David.
The process of traveling into Syria across the Turkey border 2 years ago was easy. And I can say that with confidence because smugglers smuggled me across that border and I traveled to Aleppo in October 2012. It has been argued that Turkey, by allowing such loose border controls, in effect, perhaps not intentionally, help the Islamist militants who evolved into two groups, Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda affiliate, and the Islamic State, which is rejected by al-Qaeda. Today, the Turks say that they're exercising much greater control. They do have a no-fly list. Intelligence cooperation from European countries and the U.S. is better so that they get names of people who they should not allow on flights to Istanbul or Ankara, and they will block those people. And they'll give you a list of some thousands of people who have been stopped and prevented from coming.
And Vice President Biden just in Turkey to talk about some of these
issues? He's there to talk about the issue of stopping the flow of foreign fighters. More broadly, he's talking about the issue of how Turkey is going to cooperate with the international coalition that, in theory, is going to, using President Obama's words, degrade and ultimately destroy the Islamic State. You can't do that really without Turkish help, and there hasn't been much.
Natan.
And for the Turks, of course, there's this dilemma here. On the one hand, the last thing they want to see is the Islamic State take over Syria. They feel threatened that they're the bordering country. On the other hand, they don't want to see any move that will embolden the Kurdish minority there that could cause them domestic problems as well. So that's why we've seen Erdogan kind of try to play it both ways for a while. And I think that's one of the goals of Vice President Biden is to convince Turkey Turkey to join in a more significant way, in a more active way, this battle.
So how likely is he to have any success at all with the Turks?
I think the experience we've had with the Turks is that nothing is ever closed in that in those meetings. Nothing is ever finalized. I'm sure there'll be some success, but it's a process. It's always a process.
You agree?
I do, actually. And I think President Erdogan also initiated a policy of like a humanitarian corridor. We wanted people to stay inside Syria a while ago, but then he retracted on that. Even when somebody was willing to discuss the idea, I was told, and he wasn't really forthcoming on that. But I think, as Nathan said, the Kurdish issue is fundamental for him. So yes, they helped in the foreign fighters in the beginning because they thought the strongest against ISIS, against the regime, but in the end, the Kurdish card will trump everything else.
Not yet. Bill Basie, she's a senior correspondent at Al Arabiya. And we'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll open the phones. I look forward to hearing from you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Citrix with GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device. More at GoToMeeting.com. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And from the Langloth Foundation, supporting innovative health and mental health programs for underserved populations at langloth.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Alan Cumming. He's starring in a revival of Cabaret as the MC in a Berlin nightclub of debauchery during Hitler's rise. Cumming also has a new memoir. And we listen back to our interview with film director Mike Nichols, who has died at the age of 83. Join us.
Labor, rest, stay. Welcome and bienvenue at
Welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup. Time to open the phones now. First to Tony in St. Petersburg, Florida. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane, for taking my call.
Surely.
I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
My question for the panel is, why is it so difficult to shut down the websites that basically are all over the world? There's so many young people, not just from France, but from all over the world joining them. Why isn't there a concerted effort to trace them and shut them down and have young people working on that? I mean, I'm sure, you know, Microsoft and Bill Gates could get involved in some of that too, but it's just a shame. They're basically recruiting both men and women from all over the world in all different countries.
David.
Well, there's several interesting questions involved in Tony's question. First, from a freedom of speech standpoint, do we believe that people should be allowed to have websites, even horrific websites, inciting violence, or do we believe that they should be shut down? That's an historic question for freedom of speech advocates that they've struggled over for centuries.
But isn't it akin to shouting fire?
I would say that it is. The issue that you – I mean, so typically I think in these conflicts there are two approaches you can take. You can shut down the website. You can say this constitutes a danger now to U.S. and other soldiers, civilians. Shut it down. Or you can say this group that's using the website is itself dangerous, but for intelligence purposes, we need to know everything we possibly can about who's going to that website, who they're in touch with, what they do after they visited the website, so we can begin to build a profile of who they are and then take more concrete action, not just, you know, cutting it off.
Yeah.
That would be, people would argue, that'd be the stupidest thing you could do. Some of the things that you might do from an intelligence standpoint are harder now, I think, in the post-Snowden environment, where the ability to use electronic tools for intelligence purposes has been reduced. But I'm sure this is going. I'll tell you one other thing, interesting thing that people are discussing. What about if you're sitting in Britain or in France, and a young person goes to a jihadist website and sees this stuff glorifying violence? What if something pops up on your screen and says, "This is not the Islamic way," and quotes sections of the Quran or hadith sayings of the Prophet that show that this is wrong, and sort of counter-propagandizes. That's something that I know people in this countering violent extremism world are thinking about. It also raises First Amendment-type issues, but it's kind of an interesting idea to say, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Here's the other side of
Absolutely.
This.
Absolutely.
Actually, the most interesting thing that most of these, the ruthless among all the ISIS guys are the new convert to Islam. And according to, actually, John Kerry quoted this, that most of the jihadists who go to Syria, they order Quran for dummies and Islam for dummies, because which is a series that, you know, that is used for people who don't know anything about a topic. So basically, they are really unfamiliar with the rules of the ethics of Islam or what the religion stands for. So it's very easy for a new convert who trying to prove himself even more Muslim than the other Muslims to be extreme in their views. So yes, I agree with this point that it should be somebody, and it should be more voices from the moderate Arab world who stands up and explain what Islam is all about to these
but
people.
But in our free society, David, I hear you saying if you shut down one, another will pop up.
These are very sophisticated young technologists, and their ability to mirror the servers that are initially carrying the video that you would see or the chat group that you would join, you know, those servers are mirrored 100, 1,000 times over, and these folks are real good at that.
All right, to Fort Collins, Colorado. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hello, Diane, and to your guest. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Certainly.
Regarding a comment that or an observation that David Ignatius made earlier about some 1,400 tribal leaders in Anbar over the last 5 years being killed by the ISIS organization. It seems to me that as Commander-in-Chief, President Obama, along with the CIA and the military, should have had insight to this during these past 5 years and could have been, in some manner, informing the American people, preparing for what seemed inevitable, and counteracting this in some respect, prepare us for this. Instead, it seems in the last 6 months to 9 months is when we found out about ISIS and the threat that they pose. How does this reflect upon the administration and President Obama as Commander-in-Chief? Thank you very much. And I'll take this offline.
All right. Thanks, Natan.
I think in general, everyone can agree that there was some kind of a lack of credible intelligence in terms of what is going on in Iraq and later on in the Syrian in civil war. In a sense, the Western intelligence was trying to catch up and not always very successfully in figuring out who are the forces on the ground and what their next move is going to be. Having said that, it is clear that the administration identified what they see as their key target or their key enemy in the region, which is ISIS right now, and who the key allies are. as this war progresses, we have to wait and see if this actually works, if you can limit the battle to ISIS without expanding it, as we're already seeing now, to al-Nusra, to other al-Qaeda-related groups, and if you can actually count on those Sunnis on the ground to do the work for the Americans, to do the boots-on-the-ground work, as David was saying.
I want to ask you all about the 43 missing students in Mexico and the major protests that are continuing. What did they hope to accomplish, Nadia?
Well, for a country that's been plagued with violence from drug cartel, from crime cartel, this is even more shocking, and it's actually galvanized the public to go into demonstrations because 43 people disappearing.
Young people,
university students who were protesting against education reforms, and all of a sudden the police opens fires, killing six people. And then the rumor now, I mean, there's no final reports to support that, that actually they've been handed over to the drug cartel and they've been killed, and some saying they've been burnt and their bodies being just like buried and disappeared and nobody knows where they are. So the demonstrators in the beginning, they wanted them alive. As they said, they've been arrested alive, we want them alive. Now they move to a whole wave against the government of President Pino Nieto. And it coupled with also a corruption scandal involving his wife, who wanted to build this mansion with millions of dollars, with a businessman who's closely associated with the president. So people were fed up. And this massive demonstrations, not just in Mexico itself, but also in the United States, where there's a huge Latino community from New York to Los Angeles saying we need accountability. And this wave of protest against the president of Mexico has even reached him in Australia when he was attending the G20 summit. I don't know if it's going to result in anything, because 98% of all crimes in Mexico are unresolved. I mean, can you believe that?
And the protesters really want to oust the president, David.
They have personalized it on him, his family. What's striking is that President Peña Nieto seemed, in his first months in office, to have turned a corner. The terrible drug violence in northern Mexico that was making places that were once, you know, sort of havens for industry like Monterrey, no-go zones. It seemed to have been turned, and the new government was credited with having made progress, with having reached out in various ways. And I think this latest wave of public rage over the 43 kids shows that the new president is back where the previous president was, with an angry country and a real problem with basic law and order.
Aren't they at this point assuming those students are dead, Natan?
Yes, the information they have is that the police force that arrested these students just gave them over to thugs from the cartel who murdered them, burnt their bodies, and either threw them in the river or buried them. But they still want to have answers. This just goes to the main problem that all the Mexican presidents had to deal with, which was this cooperation between the local police and the drug cartels. And trying to break this nexus between the two of them is the main challenge that none of these presidents were successful in.
Here's an email from Michael in Newark, California, who says, regarding the 43 students abducted a few months ago, apparently by orders of the local mayor and his wife, I've been pondering over the motive for such an act. What was the mayor trying to achieve? Now, we had heard that originally the students were going to protest the mayor's wife as she was about to make a speech, and he did not want that to happen. Was that actually the motive?
Diane, I'm like your caller. I find that the biggest mystery of all. Why did this happen in the first place?
Gosh.
It seems it's such a nightmarish consequence from what initially seems small motivations, but there may be dimensions of this that we don't know.
All right, Dan, let's go to Dan in Watertown, New York. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. very good conversation today. I'd like to just, if I could, elaborate a little bit on the ISIS thing and ask this question. You know, they're pretty cruel and callous and right in the face of everybody and around the world with their videos and their PR game and what have you. And some of the suggestions I'm hearing are really good, a good foundation, but it really doesn't solve the problem. So here's my question. You know, the world united and rallied around defeating communism and fascism and Nazism. And with this in the world's face, because it really is, and if it's not stopped dramatically, and I'm not saying the actions we're taking on the bombing and other things is not having some impact, but I'm just wondering why there's not more of a united front against them. I guess that's my basic question.
Well, first of all, there is some kind of a front. There is obviously a coalition led by the United States, but with maybe 60 countries participating in some form or shape. So there is an international response. But the sad news is that this is something that is going on in one region of the world, in a small region. It's affecting mainly the people of the Iraq and of Syria. It's affecting mainly Muslim population with a few foreign aid workers and journalists. I don't think you can compare it to fighting Nazism or communism in the past. There is no world response because basically the world doesn't care that much.
Do you agree the world does not care?
Well, I think certainly if you look at the non-reaction to the killing of 200,000 Syrians, the world didn't care enough to intervene decisively, and the world cared only when the regime of Bashar al-Assad began using chemical weapons, which violated a global norm. I think that President Obama decided, as he looked at the situation, wanting so much not to get back into Iraq, that standing aside was simply not possible in terms of U.S. security, that if these people were left unchallenged at the frontier of Jordan, Jordan itself would be at risk. If Jordan is at risk, Saudi Arabia is at risk. So I think there's a feeling you've got to take action.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Does that mean then we really are going to not only put 1,500 troops on the ground, but that it will escalate likely?
It will escalate, but I do not see that President Obama will take a decision whereby it's going to be boots on the ground. His strategy so far is still, as much as it's criticized, as basically bombing from the air and creating a local coalition on the ground. But who are these people? As David said, the Sahwa, which is General Petraeus used in the previous war in Iraq, had been eliminated by ISIS because they know very well who their enemy and they wanted to get rid of them before they can be a potent threat to them. And in Syria, I mean, the strategy of training the Free Syrian Army is not working either. I just got back from the region and I spoke to many military leaders and most of them said to me, I don't know where the Americans, I don't know who you're talking about, where General Allen is meeting and who is he talking to because they have not approached us yet. And also even it's kind of an absurd concept of taking people out as if the situation is just like normal, whereby you take people out of the battlefield, you train them in Saudi Arabia, which has been going on for a while anyway, or Jordan, and then bring them back. I think we're going to end up in a situation whereby you're going to have ISIS is consolidating its grip on many parts of Syria, and you're going to have Jabhat al-Nusra, the new emerging power in Idlib province that's been liberated in the beginning from the regime, and you're going to have the regime, and you're going to end up in a complete and total mess.
And the question that that brings is how long can the U.S. sit aside on the sidelines when there is this mess going on before intervening? And as we've seen in the past, it's usually not about a strategic decision. It's about some kind of a trigger on the ground, something awful that happens that requires a reaction, that it triggers international response. And that can very likely happen. So even though I don't think there is any plan here in Washington to increase the military involvement, sometimes these things are just inevitable.
What is going to happen, David?
Well, you know, we wish we knew. The core of President Obama's approach to this has been to say, if ISIS is stopped, it will be stopped because people in the region take the lead. And he was wise, I think, in saying, we will not provide military assistance to Iraq until you get rid of this divisive, polarizing Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and get somebody who might get greater confidence in the country. That was sensible. In many other ways, Obama has said to the Arabs, who are most threatened by this absolutely toxic movement, we are not going to do the fighting for you and let you hold our coat while we go out and send our troops in to fight and die. We're not going to do that again. And so if you feel threatened by this, you need to stand up and we'll help you. And I think that's the question. People in the Arab world, this is an existential challenge to any kind of modern life. And unless they're prepared to stand up and fight, it's going to be a hard, long fight, they're going to lose their wonderful part of the world for a while.
David Ignatius, columnist for The Washington Post, contributor to the Postpartisan blog at WashingtonPost.com. His latest novel is titled The Director. Nadia Bill Basie, senior correspondent at Al Arabiya, and Natan Gutman, Washington correspondent for Channel 1, Israeli News, and the Jewish Daily Forward. Thank you all.
Thanks, Diane.
Have a good weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Urv-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and